the Blackskins. I want to know, how come? Answer me that, Mr. Green Lantern. I can't. When O'Neill saw the page proofs, he realized for the first time that the book had been given to Neil Adams to illustrate.
And I looked at the first page and thought, my God, this is great. And got to the end of the first chapter, and he did that black guy's face. And this is the tragedy of slavery encapsulated in this one incredible drawing. And we were off and running.
The conclusion of the story literally had Green Lantern and Green Arrow off and running, deciding that true superheroes needed to, in Green Arrow's words, forget about chasing around the galaxy and remember America. Lantern and Arrow, accompanied by one of Green Lantern's blue-skinned alien guardians, decide to go on an extended road trip incognito. In O'Neill's words, seeking an identity, an answer, to find America, to learn why this land of the free has become the land of the fearful. It was, in many ways, the comic book equivalent of the 1969 film Easy Rider, with the soundtrack to Paul Simon's lyrics from the following year. And we walked off to look for America. For the next 8 issues, Green Lantern and Green Arrow, eventually joined by the Black Canary, a middle-rank heroine from the 1940s who served as Green Arrow's paramour, traversed the country, confronting inequity, prejudice, and cruelty among striking workers, oppressed Native Americans, polluters, brainwashed schoolchildren, and would-be messiahs. In essence, they battled the same kind of bullies and miscreants tackled by Superman in Siegel and Shuster's stories from the late 1930s. But O'Neill and Adams crafted their stories at a level never previously seen in comic books. In particular, Adams' photorealistic art style and innovative composition matched O'Neill's hardcore journalistic style. The work looked as if it were torn from that day's front pages. Of course, there were the obligatory action sequences, also rendered with a heart-racing momentum, courtesy of Adams, but Green Lantern's extraordinary powers were taken down several notches to make the character's Vondriar seem reasonably credible. Like the Lantern and the Arrow, O'Neill and Adams were on a mission. Reflected Adams, I grew up at a time when I was told many times that comic books were analogous to toilet paper. So we made our own little statement in our comic book. It reminded college students and high school students that comic books weren't just crap. O'Neill and Adams had tackled most of the statements about which they felt passionate, but the issue of drug abuse was still closed off to them by the comic's code. It was an issue that Adams wanted to explore more deeply, and he had a notion, perverse perhaps, that Green Arrow's trusty ward from the old days might be a useful character to investigate the problem. His name was Speedy, a resonant name for a potential heroin addict. That idea had too much street potency, so it was tabled by DC's editorial staff. But over at Marvel Comics, Stan Lee was moving forward with his drug-related series in The Amazing Spider-Man. He felt so strongly about it that he wanted to publish it without the code seal of approval. Publisher Goodman supported him, and The Amazing Spider-Man number 96 hit the streets in late February of 1971. It would be the first mainstream superhero comic book to be published without the code seal of approval since its inception in 1955, as were the 2 subsequent issues in the series. The roof did not cave in. Comic book distributors still put the magazine on their racks and stands. It was one of the most popular titles in the business, after all. The book sold like it always sold, recalled Lee. But we got more mail from teachers and parents and doctors and everybody all over the country saying how much they loved that book and how delighted they were. And the folks in Washington liked it. So after that, they got a little bit more lenient at the Comic Code office. Indeed, that spring, the code loosened their restrictions somewhat, especially in the area of narcotics, some sexual situations, and, amusingly, monsters. This allowed O'Neill and Adams officially to tackle the monster of drug addiction. Recalled Adams, "The next book that came out was Green Lantern Green Arrow number 85 in summer 1971. Denny sat down and wrote a two-parter for that heroine cover, and we put it out. One of the most revolutionary covers there ever was. But it took Stan to get it sold. Incredible." Snowbirds Don't Fly was the first of a two-part series where Green Arrow investigates a heroin ring, unaware that his neglected ward Speedy is at the center of it. In the next issue, "They Say It Will Kill Me, But They Won't Say When," Green Arrow discovers Speedy's addiction and uneasily guides him toward withdrawal. Unlike anything before it in comic book history, the narrative of the adventure was woven directly and thrillingly into the tragedy of the times. At one point, the henchman of a drug kingpin injects Green Arrow and Green Lantern with heroin in order to incapacitate them. This new trend of comics for grown-ups made the front page of the New York Times Magazine, the first time comic books had been given that kind of showcase, let alone praise. In Shazam! Here Comes Captain Relevant, published on May 2, 1971, after the Spider-Man stories, but before the Speedy storyline, the author wrote, "Today's superhero is about as much like his predecessors as today's child is like his parents." Alas, Green Lantern Green Arrow, the most critically acclaimed and media-celebrated comic book of its day, also suffered from a dichotomy between fans and consumers. 3 issues after the drug abuse storyline, the title was canceled, due, ostensibly, to poor sales. Perhaps its day in the sunlight of topicality had peaked. "The title was in danger of becoming Cause of the Month's comics," said O'Neill. Many fans, and some insiders, felt uneasy that a superhero title would sell its action-packed birthright for a pot of message. Still, in its time, Green Lantern Green Arrow, a contrived title if ever there was one, attained an exceptionally high standard as a groundbreaking work of art. Far more explosively than Green Lantern's power ring, and far more incisively than Green Arrow's weaponry, O'Neill and Adams had used their narrative powers to destroy the wall that arbitrarily separated comic book fantasy from the real world. The shockwaves that reverberated when fantasy combusted with reality would be felt for the next 4 decades. Chapter 5. Worlds Will Live, Worlds Will Die, The Expansion of a Universe. The Horror, the Horror. Titles from the Crypt. If your name were Marv Wolfman, imagine how tough things could get during your junior high school recess in Flushing, Queens. But even worse, perhaps, would be having your name restricted by the Comics Code Authority. DC Comics published an on-again, off-again mystery anthology entitled The House of Secrets, whose anodyne title was prescribed by the code. Writer Len Wein, who contributed a variety of scripts to the series, pointed out, "For years under the code, you couldn't use the word horror, you couldn't use the word terror, and so for a while we fudged around the edges. You know, there was House of Mystery, there was House of Secrets, but nothing that was House of Scary anything." In 1969, Young Comics writer Marv Wolfman contributed a story to House of Secrets. "It's my real name," he said. "God knows nobody would choose that." Back then, the writers of the anthology tales were never given a story credit. The title's editor, Jerry Conway, wanted to acknowledge his bullpen in some way, and he had the narrator of the comic book refer to a tale told to him by, quote, "a wandering wolf man." When that issue of House of Secrets was submitted to the Comics Code Authority, they demanded that Wolfman be removed, citing its restrictions against werewolves and other lycanthropes. "What if it's the guy's actual name?" asked Conway. In that case, the Code Authority gave a practical dispensation. If DC pasted up a blurb to that effect, they would relent. And that's how Marv Wolfman got his first writing credit in a comic book. If the House of Secrets had been able to keep its powder dry 2 more years, it wouldn't have mattered. When the Comics Code Authority made its revisions in February 1971, it broadened the possibilities of reintroducing horror and terror into the world of comics. Vampires, ghouls, and werewolves shall be permitted to be used when handled in the classic tradition, such as Frankenstein, Dracula, and other high-caliber literary works. The crypt gates were flung wide open, and the tomb raiding began. Marvel Comics exploited the possibilities with abandon almost as soon as the code ruling was announced. Under its new editor-in-chief, Roy Thomas, they floated the idea of a scientific vampire supervillain called Morbius in the pages of The Amazing Spider-Man. The character was enthusiastically embraced by readers, so Marvel quickly moved ahead with various showcases and titles featuring a shuffling swamp vegetation humanoid called the Man-Thing, a wolfman in Werewolf by Night, the godfather of all vampires in The Tomb of Dracula, a motorcyclist daredevil with a flaming skull for a head in Ghost Rider, the eponymous monster of Frankenstein, a mummy character conceived as a mummified Nubian slave revived in 1972, Brother Voodoo, who fought the undead in Haiti, the self-evident zombie, several daughters and sons of Satan, even the Golem, that statuesque defender of the Jewish people, was revived to fight the after-effects of the 1973 Yom Kippur War in the Holy Land. The monster explosion also occurred in a series of parallel publications produced by a new venture of Marvel's publishers, Black and White magazines, which were larger in size and volume and utterly unrestricted by the Comics Code Authority. As tantalizing and as unfettered as these horror omnibuses were, they didn't last out the 1970s. The monster characters found a more congenial home in the full-color comics, which makes a kind of sense, since the monstrous Hulk and the Thing had already straddled both the superhero and the monster genres. Even Batman was at his best as a creature of the night. Speaking of Batman, the most successful of Marvel's horror ventures was The Tomb of Dracula, which continued an epic and convoluted narrative over 7 years, guided inestimably and almost entirely by the artist Gene Colan, the only comic book artist who could draw fog convincingly, and its scriptwriter, none other than Marv Wolfman. The Ghost Rider spun his wheels into a couple of movies in the 21st century, and Blade the Vampire Hunter, who was created for the Tomb of Dracula series, also became a Hollywood fixture in 3 separate films. DC Comics was clearly outdrawn, as it were, by Marvel's buckshot approach to monsterdom, but the revised code also cleared the way for Len Wein and artist Bernie Wrightson to expand on a character they had created in 1971 for the House of Secrets, another sentient, vegetative humanoid called Swamp Thing. Swamp Thing was given his own title in 1972. Along with the Man-Thing at Marvel, in a very different but equally imaginative series of tales, there was something about sentient, vegetative humanoids that lent themselves to wonderfully metaphoric suspense tales. Perhaps it was all the concern about the environment and ecology in the mid-1970s. In any event, Ghost Rider, Man-Thing, Swamp Thing, and even Dracula have survived the 70s surge and been successfully assimilated into the universes of their respective publishers. As much as the younger writers and artists of both companies may have enjoyed tackling the forbidden creatures of yesteryear, the titles were almost uniformly given to up-and-coming creators, the vast expansion of these titles had as much to do with business practice as it did with the new freedoms of the Comics Code. By 1969, Marvel publisher Martin Goodman had shed his onerous newsstand distribution deal that had corseted the company for years. Space was finally freed up to give almost all the main characters their own books. Combined with the new ventures into horror, within 3 years, Marvel had almost quadrupled the number of titles they put out every month. Many were anthologies and reprints of both superhero and monster books from the early 1960s, but just as many were new characters, such as the science fiction-tinged Warlock, or the Kung Fu Masters, Shang-Chi, or Iron Fist. Guided by Roy Thomas, Marvel also dove headfirst into the licensing business, an area previously reigned over by Dell or Gold Key Publishing. The pulp sword and sorcery pioneer Conan the Barbarian began his long and violent history with Marvel in 1971, and even Doc Savage made a brief, if well-drawn, appearance in 1972. Not to be outdone, DC Comics licensed Tarzan, revived the Captain Marvel character in a series called Shazam, the M-word was now off-limits, and reintroduced the Shadow to comic books in some very atmospheric tales. At the time, Stan Lee joked that if DC licensed the pulp hero the Spider, Marvel would have to license the Black Bat. But Marvel really hit pay dirt when Thomas had the foresight to license an underpromoted science fiction movie before its 1977 release, Star Wars. Licensing was also extended beyond properties and characters that existed in the print media. In the 1960s, there had been limited spin-offs that provided certain toys with their own comic books. Captain Action, a 12-inch doll who could wear the costumes of other superheroes, was the granddaddy of all action figures, the first, in fact, to use that term, and had a brief run at DC Comics. But from the late 1970s on, there were more complicated relationships between toy companies and comic book publishers. A posable robot, called Rom the Space Knight, was licensed to Marvel to create stories that would provide both a narrative and a buzz for the product. The comic was more successful than the toy. The Micronauts comic book was a Marvel initiative, where the comic book piggybacked on a line of miniature toys originally produced by a Japanese company. In the early 1980s, the Hasbro toy manufacturer acquired another line of Japanese toys, little robots which could transform themselves into cars, planes, toaster ovens, you name it, and worked with Marvel and some of its best writers, including Denny O'Neil, to create a mythos and a backstory for the toys. It became the Transformers, a dominating titan in the industry. The relationship between toys and comics was no mere child's play. The respective industries would work together into the 21st century, creating complex, multi-platform launches that would encompass endless narratives supporting a battalion of robots, aliens, and action figures who marched down the aisles of Kmart and Toys R Us for decades. These expansive relationships with large corporations were manifestations of the fact that both Marvel and DC Comics would become part of corporations themselves and would undergo tremendous structural transitions as a result of corporate buyouts. Marvel would become a subsidiary of Cadence Industries, a publishing company that had gotten its start in pharmaceuticals, and DC Comics would be taken over by Kinney National Company, a conglomerate built on parking lots and construction, which would soon metamorphose into Warner Communications. The pressure to produce was tremendous. Neither of the corporate entities was run by folks who came out of the 30-odd-year-old comics industry. Soon the carefully cherished characters and narratives had to square off against a new adversary, the bottom line. As a parting shot to his distinguished competition, publisher Goodman raised the price of his comics from 15 to 25 cents and doubled the page count. When DC followed suit, Goodman immediately reversed his policy, cut back the size of the books, and charged 20 cents per copy. DC hung in there for a while with the 25-cent price tag, but had been essentially undercut in the marketplace, and was now stuck with overpriced comic books. Kids could buy 5 Marvel books for a dollar, rather than 4 with the DC Comics logo. DC never quite recovered. By the time the Watergate scandal had ousted Richard Nixon from the White House, another authority figure had been routed. DC had ceded their 3-decade market share to Marvel Comics. It would require a game-changer to reshuffle the deck. Luckily, DC Comics owned the first and most super game-changer of them all. The X-Men. So the last shall be first, and the first last. For many be called, but few chosen, it says in Matthew 20:16. And that makes a good epigraph for the X-Men, a comic book series that would develop as large a cast of characters and as vast an apocrypha as the New Testament itself. In many ways, the original X-Men were pretty much the last of the Marvel Universe. Invented by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby in 1963, the Band of Young Mutants was abandoned by its creators after about a dozen issues. Again, fittingly, because many of the mutant characters in the book had been abandoned by their own families, who were terrified or bewildered by their superpowers. Without a consistent creative team behind them, the X-Men seemed doomed to bring up the rear of the Marvel vanguard for the first 7 years of their existence, always selling poorly, but not poorly enough to be canceled. In retrospect, it's curious as to why the X-Men were so undervalued. They seemed to have an awful lot going for them. They were young, they were different, they were trained at a special school, they bickered with each other, and yet clearly admired each other. Their powers were pretty cool, too. Warren Worthington III was the scion of a wealthy family who could fly thanks to a pair of white wings. He became the Angel. Hank McCoy had steroidal feet and hands and could bound about like a beast. Originally the boisterous Thing of the group, he soon developed a loquacious and literary manner of speaking. Iceman was young Bobby Drake, who could turn himself and the air's very molecules into ice, making him pretty popular at cocktail parties. Jean Grey became Marvel Girl, thanks to her powers of telekinesis, allowing her to move objects without lifting a finger. This skill, in addition to her red-haired attractiveness, made her a little standoffish. Scott Summers was the scout leader of the group, a serious fellow, in love with Jean Grey, and cursed with the ability to shoot powerful red beams from his eyes. He couldn't turn them off without a special visor, and earned the name Cyclops. Putting these teenagers through their paces was Charles Xavier, known as Professor X, as beneficent a mentor as one could find, and also possessed of a mutant attribute that made him the world's most powerful telepath. Professor X trained his students at the Xavier Institute for Higher Learning. As Stan Lee recounted, he was afraid that people would fear the X-Men if they knew about their power, so he kept them hidden in what seemed to be a school for gifted youngsters, but nobody knew how gifted they were. From the beginning, the X-Men had a compelling duality to them. They were powerful and vulnerable in equal measures. Much of the X-Men subtext had to do with the prejudice against them as mutants. In issue number 14, they were hunted down by immense robotic sentinels, who were designed by a mad doctor intent on keeping mutants, Homo superior, as they were called, from infecting the world of Homo sapiens. On the other end of the spectrum was the X-Men's grand nemesis, Magneto, who could manipulate any kind of metallic object. Himself persecuted as a mutant, and revealed many years later to have been an inmate at Auschwitz as a child, Magneto vowed to revenge himself on humanity's small-mindedness by destroying them and elevating mutants to become the natural rulers of the planet. In his mad mission, Magneto placed himself in direct opposition to Charles Xavier, and their Manichaean struggles for the souls, and talents, and membership status, of the Earth's mutants accounted for many, many storylines. Although some first-rate artists, such as Jim Steranko and Neil Adams, were brought onto the magazine in the late 1960s, there wasn't much hope for the young mutants. In 1970, they were the first to be last. The first ongoing superhero title of the early Marvel Age of Comics to be canceled. Cyclops, The Beast & Co. puttered around other titles in various incarnations until the marketing-minded Roy Thomas thought that the team could be reconstituted along international lines. In other words, as writer Len Wein put it, since a lot of the Marvel books were selling very well internationally, If they put together a team of characters who would represent the countries where these books were already selling, they could sell this new book even better in... name the country. Ween was already working on The Incredible Hulk, and created a fierce Canadian upstart called Wolverine, just so Marvel could have a Canadian superhero at their disposal, if the situation ever called for it. Little did Ween know that he would be the writer assigned to reconstitute the X-Men team for Giant Size X-Men number 1 in the spring of 1975. The artist of the new series was Dave Cockrum, whose characters were both action-oriented and affable. He had cut his teeth on the largest superhero group of all time, the Legion of Superheroes at DC Comics. Apparently, no one ever gave Ween and Cockrum that magic list of designated countries, so they assembled a new team out of some old sketches for other projects and their gut instincts. The new X-Men were vital and diverse to an almost dizzying degree. The metal-clad Colossus hailed from Soviet Russia. He questioned whether or not his power belonged to the state. The shrieking Banshee was from Ireland. The elemental goddess Storm was the reigning deity in Kenya. The indigo-colored Nightcrawler was a hobgoblin from Germany. And Wolverine dutifully, if grumpily, represented Canada. A Japanese hero named Sunfire bailed after the first issue, and a Native American warrior named Thunderbird went on a suicide mission in the third issue. No one much missed him. He was not a team player. The new group was recruited by Professor X and was unofficially led by Cyclops, the one X-Man who decided to stay on. "We never ever to this day found out what countries we were supposed to have used," said Ween. "I guess maybe I should have had a Spanish guy. I don't know. We just did the group we thought was fun." Readers thought they were pretty fun, too. Ween almost immediately left the book to be replaced by Chris Claremont, whose 17-year tenure on the X-Men was, and is, unparalleled in the annals of comic books. Claremont had a particular gift for creating sympathetic characters, especially female ones, and he could spin out issue upon issue of epic space operas. He also understood that the X-Men's collective Achilles heel, their ostracization by humanity, was the key to their narrative appeal. "I'm out here, saving the universe, I've done it 3 times, and I still get a weird look when I walk down the street," Claremont imagined an X-Man as saying. "Thanks a lot. Well, no good deed goes unpunished." Claremont and Cockrum had made the X-Men viable again, and the book snowballed in popularity as it moved into the 1980s. A heart-wrenching saga involved Jean Grey morphing into a powerful entity called the Dark Phoenix, with the power to wreak havoc on human and mutant kind alike. She committed suicide rather than submit to the dark forces within her. Imaginatively crafted younger mutants arrived to Xavier's school to fill out the ranks. A particularly intriguing young woman named Rogue was incapable of touching another human being without absorbing all of their memories and abilities, and it was her curse. She was, in many ways, the logical extension of the tortured characters created by Stan Lee in the 1960s. "They were underdogs," said Louise Simonson, who edited the series in the 1990s. "Although they were extremely powerful characters, they perceived themselves as the underdogs." Readers suddenly couldn't get enough of the X-Men. But where were all these fans in 1969? The short answer is that they probably hadn't been born yet. The X-Men and their manifold spin-offs, the New Mutants, X-Factor, Excalibur, X-Force, to name but the first few, touched a particular chord in young people. Christina Strain, a Marvel colorist who was born in South Korea and emigrated to the United States, sees the appeal of the multiracial, multigenetic group. "They were a band of misfits who came together because they were all different. It's like high school. You get to watch all of these people who don't like each other have to work together as a group, and somebody is betraying somebody else, and somebody's got a super secret that they're trying to keep, and there's romance within the ranks, and everybody can identify with high school. Perhaps the X-Men's heroic dilemma was embraced because they were the first truly multicultural superhero team. By the early 1980s, cultural diversity, political correctness, and ethnicity had entered the national discourse. Many of these conflicts of difference and community were played out directly and painfully in colleges, workplaces, and neighborhoods around the country. Chris Claremont sees the parallel. In the X-Men's case, we have an impossible obstacle, but we have to find a way to win. That's an echo, a parallel for what goes on within the culture of the country itself. Over the last 35 years, how many people of extraordinarily varied persuasions have come up to me and said, "The X-Men speak to me. I'm gay, I'm black, I'm Asian, I'm an immigrant." Why? Because they're outsiders trying to fit in and getting no credit for all the good that they do, but not losing faith in the struggle. Still determined that the goal is worth the effort and the sacrifice, and that has a resonance. By the end of the 1980s, it seemed as if everyone who had ever considered him or herself an outsider was buying X-Men and or its affiliated titles. It became the most successful comic book conglomerate of all time, spawning hundreds of characters and dozens of storylines. Claremont assessed that if all the X-Men-oriented comic books were spun off from Marvel Comics, they would constitute one of the largest comic book publishers in the country. The last were now officially first. At the very end of Giant Size X-Men number 1 in 1975, the Angel pondered a simple problem. What are we going to do with 13 X-Men? Had he but known that within 4 decades, the number of X-Men and their devoted following would be legion. Believing a Man Can Fly. Superman, the movie. In the entire contents of Mario Puzo's submitted 500-page screenplay for the first major motion picture based on Superman, there was not one word as important as the one that director Richard Donner ultimately had emblazoned on his office wall. Verisimilitude. Superman's journey to the multiplex was one of his more arduous adventures. Toward the end of 1973, two foreign film producers, Alexander Salkind and his son Ilya, were contemplating their next project. They had just put together a mammoth international version of Dumas' The Three Musketeers, so mammoth it would eventually be released in 2 parts, an unprecedented event in itself, and they were looking for something equally adventurous and monumental. Although, rumor has it, the elder Salkin had never heard of Superman, he was persuaded by his son that it was just the property they needed, and the Salkin set about acquiring the rights from Warner Communications. It may be difficult to imagine a time when there had never been a full-length, big-budget Hollywood film about a superhero, but with the exception of the hastily patched-together 1966 movie with the Batman television cast, the Salkin's project was without precedent. Luckily, the producers had the temerity, if not quite the means, to break the mold in a superlative way. In the 4 years it took them to negotiate the rights from Warner Brothers, commission a screenplay, initially from Mario Puzo, famed for his novel and screenplay for The Godfather, acquire a director, several had come and gone before Richard Donner signed, cast the picture, and begin shooting at England's Pinewood Studios in March 1977, there was a parallel phenomena of dumping superheroes onto the primetime television schedule, as well as Saturday morning television cartoons. Spider-Man and Captain America fared poorly, while Wonder Woman, embodied with statuesque pep by Linda Carter, came off more successfully. The Incredible Hulk launched a successful television run right before Superman debuted in movie theaters. An ill-conceived Doc Savage motion picture was barely released in 1975. The superhero brand had been relegated to the living room console by this kind of exposure, so the road to Superman's multi-million-dollar motion picture showcase was littered with skeptics. Jerry Siegel couldn't even have been counted on as a skeptic. Superman's co-creator was an outright antagonist to the project. In 1975, as press releases and promotional gimmicks kept perpetuating the eventual release of a Superman film, Siegel sent a 9-page letter out to the media, detailing his outrage at national periodicals and the profligate expenditures on the upcoming film. "I, Jerry Siegel, the co-originator of Superman, put a curse on the Superman movie. I hope it super bombs. I hope loyal Superman fans stay away from it in droves. You hear a great deal about the American dream, but Superman, who in the comics and films fights for truth, justice, and the American way, has for Joe and me become an American nightmare." The letter detailed every perceived ignominy suffered by Siegel and Schuster, but the basic thrust was true. Since their failed lawsuit in the late 1940s, neither man had an ongoing, sustainable career in comics. Schuster, in fact, was almost legally blind and living in near poverty. And their ongoing credit as Superman's creators hadn't appeared in print for a quarter of a century. The media was slow to pick up the story, but artist Neil Adams, who had been an outspoken advocate for creators' rights for years, teamed up with Golden Age pioneer Jerry Robinson, who was also head of the National Cartoonists Society, to orchestrate a series of press conferences, media appearances, and general drum beatings that might force Warner Communications' hand. Thanks to Adams and Robinson, it turned out to be a very popular story. The resonant appeal was obviously in the common man against oppression trope that had served Superman so well during the Depression. As 1975 drew to a close, a series of back-and-forth negotiations between Warner and Robinson and Adams, representing Siegel and Schuster, ramped up, all in the shadow of the upcoming film. "That worked in our favor," said Robinson. "That gave us even more leverage. Warner didn't want any bad publicity on the eve of the movie." A settlement was reached. Siegel and Schuster were to receive $20,000 each a year for life. They would get incremental raises, medical coverage, a one-time bonus of $17,500 each, and most important, an issue haggled over most intensely, their credit as Superman's co-creators would be restored. Warner held out on one point. Any credit on toys and action figures was out of its hands, but the important elements were in place. The deal was concluded on the afternoon of December 23, 1975, making it a Christmas present of Dickensian proportions. Siegel and Schuster joined Robinson at his West Side apartment that night, along with other champions of their cause, and watched the CBS Evening News together as Walter Cronkite broke the scoop on the deal, which Robinson had personally let him in on. "And finally, truth, justice, and the American way won out," intoned Cronkite as everyone lifted their champagne glasses. "I'll tell you," recounted Robinson, "there wasn't a dry eye in the house." Meanwhile, as they say, production work on the film was taking an unbearably long time. Puzo's immense script draft proved unwieldy, so the Salkins brought in Robert Benton and David Newman, who had not only written the screenplay for Bonnie and Clyde, but the book to a witty, if short-lived, Broadway musical called It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman, in 1966. As the team, along with Newman's wife, Leslie, tried to focus the screenplay and make it compelling to contemporary America, the Salkins searched in vain for their leading man. It was a near impossible task, as the role was considered too demanding, so said Robert Redford, too ridiculous, Paul Newman's reason for saying no, too square, thereby knocking sexy Burt Reynolds out of competition, too all-American, sorry Sylvester Stallone, who was dying to play the part, and too unremunerative, James Caan priced himself out. Months dragged on, as Olympic decathlon champ Bruce Jenner, Muhammad Ali, Perry King, and even someone's dentist were all considered and rejected. Alexander Salkind decided to put his quickly evaporating chips on another part of the table. With a stellar supporting cast, he could raise money and credibility quickly. Marlon Brando accepted $3.7 million to play Superman's father, Jor-El, plus exorbitant percentages of the gross receipts. He would wind up working only 12 and a half days and tweaked the press by claiming he wanted to play the part as a floating green bagel, arguing that Superman's background needn't be humanoid at all. However kooky, Brando made an undeniably sensible point. Gene Hackman was signed to play Superman's arch-foe, the bald, pated Lex Luthor, although to maintain some fleeting sense of dignity, Hackman was embarrassed to be in a comic book movie. He refused to shave his head. The clout of Brando and Hackman allowed Salkin to leverage more money, and to save some overhead, he moved his production to 8 sound stages in England Shepperton Studios, which came with a tax credit. Director Richard Donner was brought on board, and he firmly insisted on that verisimilitude. Explained Donner, "It's a word that refers to being real. Not realistic, yes, there is a difference, but real. It was a constant reminder to ourselves that, if we gave in to the temptation we knew there would be to parody Superman, we would only be fooling ourselves." As 1975 stretched into 1976 and into 1977 without a starting date, Donner enlisted screenwriter Tom Mankiewicz, whose witty way with pulp material had enlivened several James Bond movies, to focus the script one more time. It was now being planned by the Salkins as a two-part movie with a $26.5 million budget. Still, the project was lacking a star and a convincing technical method that would get Superman airborne. On a flyer, as it were, the producers took one last desperate look at a skinny Juilliard-trained actor from New York who had some Broadway and soap opera experience. Christopher Reeve nearly didn't make his meeting with Salkin in New York because, rather like Hackman, he didn't think the material was serious enough. But his good looks convinced Salkin to arrange a screen test, where, apparently, it was his charming approach to Clark Kent that put him over the top. George Reeves, no relation, barely suggested a difference between Superman and his mortal disguise on the television show, but Reeve was inspired by the bumbling, bespectacled Cary Grant in Bringing Up Baby. For Reeve, Clark Kent was, quote, "a deliberate put-on by Superman. There's some of him in all of us. I have a great deal of affection for him. It's not just that he can't get the girl. He can't get the taxi." Reeve saw himself as custodian of Superman in the 1970s and seemed privileged to play the character. When he signed on for a mere $250,000 at the end of February 1977, everyone involved in the project sighed a super breath of relief. Filming finally began in March 1977, when the last essential challenge was solved: how to make it credible that Superman could fly. After testing a variety of different effects to no avail, the producers were persuaded by an optic effect created for the film called Zoptic, which allowed Reeve to lie ramrod straight on a gurney, while the specially designed zoom lenses did the rest. No pesky wires were required. Filming stretched on into fall of 1977 and then into early winter of 1978. Donner essentially had to edit two films at once and was in constant budget battles with his producers. Luckily, in the midst of being sued by both Brando and Mario Puzo, the Salkins managed to offer premium film composer John Williams enough money to score an unforgettably heroic soundtrack. Donner's completed film took the entire Superman mythos seriously, without compromising its giddy charm as an essential myth in American popular culture. Superman the movie was stylistically divided into thirds. The first part is icy, deliberate science fiction on the minimalist, sleek, crystalline planet, Krypton, where Jor-El, after sentencing three criminals to the Phantom Zone, vainly attempts to get his elder colleagues to heed his warnings about his planet's imminent destruction. He wearily, but stoically, sends his tiny young son to the planet Earth via a shimmering, jagged pod. Once young Kal-El arrives on Earth, the second third of the story, his upbringing in Smallville, takes on the yearning frontier spirit of a John Ford movie, as if it were art directed by Andrew Wyeth. When he turns 18, Clark Kent discovers his alien roots via a hologram of his father, who imparts his wisdom in theological tones. Live as one of them, Kal-El, to discover where your strength and your power are needed. Always hold in your heart the pride of your special heritage. They can be a great people, Kal-El. They wish to be. They only lack the light to show the way. For this reason, above all, their capacity for good, I have sent them you, my only son. Then the story turns to Metropolis. Location filming in New York City proved to be a very persuasive substitute, where Clark's vocation at the Daily Planet and his subsequent unrequited affair with Lois Lane was rendered with all the spark and bite of a cynical 1970s urban film, which Superman was, after all. In an impressive blend of action, adventure, comedy, nicely rendered by Hackman's Luthor, who, despite his claim of having the greatest criminal mind of our time, certainly hires the two most incompetent cohorts in history, and romance, the movie soars to a thrilling conclusion. The romance was charmingly supplied by Reeve and his co-star Margot Kidder, who brought to the screen the kind of sparking banter usually found only in Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn films. Preceded by an ad campaign that riskily taunted audiences that they would believe a man can fly, and despite its beleaguered history, Superman opened across the country on December 15, 1978, to largely enthusiastic reviews, most of them concurring that Reeve had pulled off a titanic task with persuasive flair. By spring 1979, most of the cast and crew returned to begin filming the sequel, much of which was already in the can. Although Donner had had enough dealing with the Salkins and was replaced by Richard Lester, the sequel further refined the elements that had worked in the first place, and in some cases, superior fight scenes with the power-enhanced criminals who escaped from the Phantom Zone, for example, an existential dilemma faced by Superman that stretched all the way back to Greek tragedy, it actually improved on the original. Still, the original Superman had a fortress full of happy endings for everyone. For the Salkins, whose film made nearly $300 million worldwide, providing a profit even after all the settled lawsuits. For Reeve, who went from Hollywood Superman to Hollywood superstar. For audiences, who really did believe a man could fly. For Warner Brothers, which mined three sequels out of the project. For fans, who felt that their standard bearer had been rendered in a cinematic version that was worthy of his eminence. But the happiest ending of all happened at the very beginning, some 3 minutes into the film. Two weary comic book creators had the chance to see a boldly animated credit soar across the screen. Superman, created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. And for that, you're going to die. Spider-Man meets the real world. Death had been part of the Spider-Man legend since the web-slinger's debut, casting its shadow over the life of Peter Parker's Uncle Ben, and thereby setting into motion Spider-Man's heroic obligation. When death came knocking again at The Amazing Spider-Man, twice, first literally, then figuratively, in the early 1970s, it would irrevocably change the tone of superhero comic books. The soap opera drama that made Spider-Man so unique and so compelling in the mid-1960s often revolved around Peter Parker's love life, or lack thereof. But eventually Peter's, quote, dumb luck came up sevens and he had to choose between two of the most attractive and desirable women in the world of comic books. Peter first met Gwen Stacy when he moved on to college in 1965. She was a cool platinum blonde, insofar as comic books could render platinum, with bangs, a black headband, and go-go boots. She was Peter's intellectual equal, but seemingly miles beyond him on the social scale. Mary Jane Watson, on the other hand, was originally set up for Peter as a blind date. He spent countless issues avoiding her, only to discover she was a bombshell. "Face it, Tiger, you just hit the jackpot," she famously exclaimed to him at the end of The Amazing Spider-Man number 42. Mary Jane was a redhead, a free swinging model and would-be actress, bursting with snappy repartee. She was kooky, back when that word was a signifier for the counterculture. If they had been cast in a Hollywood movie of the 1950s, Gwen would have been played by Grace Kelly, Mary Jane by Shirley MacLaine. In their graphic incarnations, they were impeccably rendered by veteran artist John Romita, who had cut his teeth on the Marvel romance comics of the late 1950s. This only made sense, as MJ and Gwenny were the Betty and Veronica to Peter Parker's Archie Andrews. By the beginning of 1973, Peter had more or less chosen Gwen. Stan Lee had moved off his fabled scripting chores on the title to spend time in his new role as Marvel's publisher, and Jerry Conway took over the reins. Conway was another member of the new generation of comic book writers, one of the youngest. In fact, he took on The Amazing Spider-Man while barely out of his teens. Conway's relative youth served him well. He was essentially the same age as Peter Parker, and trying to make a go of it in Manhattan himself in the early 1970s. Conway was particularly sympathetic to Parker's various predicaments. When Conway started on the series, there was a sense that the Spider-Man stories needed to be changed up. John Romita thought it would help if one of the characters was forced to walk the plank. Stan Lee voted for Peter's geriatric and solicitous Aunt May, but she had been on the Grim Reaper's dance card since the beginning. Aunt May's death would be sad, thought Conway, but he was going for tragic. And so, in The Amazing Spider-Man number 121, the ground was laid for a genuine game-changer in the world of comic book fantasy, amazing or otherwise. The Green Goblin had always been one of Spider-Man's major villains, but as the father of Peter's best friend, he was more insidiously involved in Parker's private life. Because of that connection, the Goblin learned of Spider-Man's alter ego and abducted Peter's girlfriend to exact his revenge. This impending peril was the reason most superheroes refused to divulge their secret identities. The Goblin tossed Gwen Stacy off the tower of a Manhattan bridge. Spider-Man shot his webbing out to catch her. Swick went the webbing. And in the saddest sound effect in comic book history, snap went Gwen Stacy's neck. She was the first major ongoing character to be killed in the course of a story. In the days before fan-based internet sites trumpeted upcoming storylines, Gwen's death was a complete surprise, a shocker, in fact. Comic book writer Mark Waid recalls, "I was 10 years old at the time, and I thought of Gwen Stacy as my girlfriend. I remember where I was reading that comic, and I remember walking around in a daze for the rest of the day, because in comics, characters didn't die. Gwen Stacy was the one good thing in Spider-Man's life, and Jerry Conway yanked that away from him. That was devastating." Conway, who professed to be far more intrigued with the character of Mary Jane as a possible paramour for Spider-Man, viewed Gwen's death as a narrative choice with the greatest dramatic effect. "Up to that point," he said, "in a comic book, a character like Superman will catch Lois Lane and she's safe. You always had the sense that at the end of the day, everything was going to be made right. But when Gwen Stacy died, there was no rational reason for it other than the tragedy of life." For Conway, Gwen's death was also a metaphor of the zeitgeist of the early 1970s. As he put it,
"We had created the ultimate anti-hero moment, and sort of emblematic of the early 70s, which was good people trying to do the right thing and messing up horribly. We were in the Vietnam War. Whatever the reasons, you know, the soldiers who went over there didn't go over there to be bad guys. They went over there to try to do the right thing. In the process, they did terrible things. And that's tragic. There was a sense, you know, that the world was not a safe and nice place. And comics hadn't really reflected that. But after the death of Gwen Stacy, comics started to reflect the real world."
the shadow of the real-world conflict would extend further into the Spider-Man title in the form of a violent Vietnam vet named Frank Castle. It's worth remembering that not only did the Marvel Universe revolve around New York City, but in the early 1970s, all of the young writing talent was living there as well. During previous generations, comic book writers and artists tended to wear ties and carry briefcases and commute into town from the suburbs of Scarsdale or Mineola. But now the talent was facing the same problems as thousands of hardened New Yorkers, and those problems were plentiful. In January of 1974, the New York Times did a survey of its citizens. 63% of residents said that crime was their number one concern. 41% said they would never set foot in Times Square, and 2 out of 5 New Yorkers expressed no confidence that a captured criminal would ever be sent to jail. Throughout the 1970s, close to 2,000 people were murdered each year in New York City alone. Clearly, in the minds of some people, something had to be done. The idea of a comic book vigilante who would take the law into his own hands was nothing new in the Western books of the 1950s, but a costumed character with such a ruthless philosophy would seem to contradict the do-gooder ethics of the superhero universe. The Punisher made his first appearance at the beginning of 1974 in the pages of The Amazing Spider-Man number 129, with a February cover date, the same month as the New York Times released its poll of the city's intimidated citizens. It was a little more than a year after Gwen Stacy's death. Gwen Stacy set the stage, and the Punisher walked onto it, said his creator, Jerry Conway. Spider-Man, as the good superhero, fails to save the innocent girl. Well, the Punisher comes along, and he's the guy who is not going to fail, because he is not going to play by society's rules. He's not going to wrap the villain up in webbing and put him on a ledge for the cops to come. He is going to eliminate the villain. Although his character was originally intended as a one-shot, the Punisher character provided a full magazine of narrative artillery. A hired assassin with the Death's Head emblem on his chest, the Punisher is manipulated by another villain to, quote, take out Spider-Man. His weapons include a lethal AK-47 and the kind of terse, humorless threats mastered by Clint Eastwood in his 1971 film, Dirty Harry. I'm an expert at many things, murderer, he tells Spider-Man, whom he blames for, among other crimes, the death of Gwen Stacy. Your kind of scum has ruled this country too long, punk, and I'm out to put a stop to it, any way I can. With a fearsome costume, although the white boots seemed both effete and impractical for someone so devoted to carnage, and a mien that resembled Robert Mitchum after several years of basic training, the Punisher immediately caught on with readers. His implacability mirrored their own frustrations, as well as the wish fulfillment of the times. The Punisher's path had been trod before, in fiction and in movies. Conway consciously modeled him on a men's action-adventure character, the Executioner, a former Green Beret-turned-mercenary in a series of popular novels begun by Don Pendleton in 1969. The Executioner inspired a plethora of other paperback vigilantes and mercenaries, the Liquidator, the Death Merchant, the Destroyer, usually former battlefield vets or CIA operatives who decide to fight crime on their own merciless terms. It was a subgenre that reached its apotheosis in 1974, when Brian Garfield's Death Wish was made into a frighteningly successful pro-vigilante film starring Charles Bronson. The Punisher, said Conway, also comes out of the incredible complexity and craziness of the Nixonian period, a social breakdown of all the rules and regulations that we had all thought we were living by. The Punisher has a simple answer to all this. I'll take care of it. You know I will do it. There's not going to be anybody between me and justice. The character became a 1970s version of the Mike Hammer detective character that Mickey Spillane created out of the disillusioned veterans of World War II. More than a year after his debut, the Punisher was given his own backstory by Conway in another Marvel magazine, an origin that reflects on his pulp antecedents. Frank Castle is a former Marine, a Vietnam vet who takes his family on a picnic in Central Park, where the 1974 New York Times